and welcome to the Inside Betting Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Trenhale. So, episode 10 feels like a milestone. Didn't think I'd get here, but pretty glad that I have. People have been very complimentary, very nice to me on Twitter. Lovely feedback on the podcast. So I certainly feel like I'm going to keep it going as long as I can. Now, finally on iTunes, which has definitely helped. Very obvious from the stats that I get fed that a large amount of you like to listen to it via iTunes in some way, and SoundCloud as well, by the looks of it. So definitely worth getting the podcast onto both of those. Just going through a little bit of admin, I just feel it's right to respond to Mark, who I believe is the Twitter handle, at TTMister, who asked me whether I had any transcripts of the podcasts for a friend who's totally deaf. I instantly feel terrible because I feel like I should have transcripts now. Unfortunately, this is just me talking pretty unscripted off the cuff. I tend to do them in one take and then just upload them and not worry too much about them. So I have nothing written down, unfortunately. So, yeah, I'm not really sure what the solution there would be. In a sort of inverse of this scenario, my father actually does a lot of reading for the blind, which he's particularly fond of words in general. So I was just thinking that there must obviously be services that will not only provide live subtitles, obviously, for movies and so on, but also provide transcripts for those who are deaf. But yeah, no, I mean, if there's anyone out there who wants to transcribe all the words I say, then they're most welcome to, and I will do everything I can to publicize it if they did. No, I'm very sorry that I can't help you at this point in time. The next thing is I'm very keen, and this is a big ask possibly, but very keen if anyone who's a bit more savvy with image creation online to replace Scott Joplin's fabulous cover for the Sting soundtrack, which I use as my logo, because I live slightly in fear of someone telling me that I can't use it. Anything which in some way incorporates the words inside and betting together would be greatly appreciated. But if not, I'm happy to keep on honouring Redford Newman and Scott Joplin in all their glory, and undoubtedly one of my favourite betting movies. I also, if possible, again, another big ask, would love the opportunity to interview anyone, just get another voice on the podcast rather than people just listening to me drone on and on. And also the possibility of maybe doing the podcast with someone. I'm always happy to guest on other people's podcasts, but it'd be nice to get someone in even now and then. So anyone who fancies having a chat about betting, and I'll just try to unobtrusively record it, do please get in contact. But I do, of course, understand that it's not for everyone. Not everyone likes the sound of their own voice anywhere near as much as I obviously must do to keep doing these and going on for so long. So, yes. Podcast distributed in the right place, as it seems, could do with a new logo and could do with someone to keep me company on it. But aside from that, all seems pretty good. And this week, I'm going to jump around, and I'm going to sort of stop doing the suggestions in chronological order in an attempt to kind of tackle things when they're current. So I found myself the other day at Olympia on the betting and sports conference, which was, it's a fairly low-key affair, to be honest. It's much more low-key than, say, ICE, if anyone's ever been to that, with, you know, far less stands, and it's much more a sort of meet-and-greet of betting providers, software, that kind of thing, and account managers and the like. But they do some lovely talks throughout the day on various different subjects. Anyway, I posted on Twitter an image of the new Pinnacle Solutions stand. This is a big thing for me because Pinnacle for many years was utterly devoted to B2C, you know, very lean operation dedicated to serving customers as best they could. And now they're going to be branching out into servicing businesses, providing their risk services and their pricing services, although slightly open to interpretation as to how much value one can sell the pricing service for when everyone's scraping the hell out of your website using your free API, etc. But yeah, that's a detail, I'm sure, for the moment. So yes, to see them with a stand in one of these shows, as opposed to just one or two representatives walking around, you know, these stands aren't cheap. It was a serious statement of intent. It's quite a busy stand. So I'm interested to see who the first big name bookmakers will be who sign up to this, and how their products change or adapt once Pinnacle's doing things on their behalf. Pinnacle is partly owned by a man who owns not only part of Pinnacle, but he also owns a good chunk of Sporting Solutions, the pricing division, I suppose, of the Sporting Index spread betting firm. They provide solutions already risk typed and trading typed to bookmakers, and also I want to say it's TouchBet. Anyway, his original business, which had a sort of gathering of retail liabilities from various recreational bookmakers, and he would then amalgamate these to provide a sort of a global price to then feed back to them. So people's bets fed into one's hub, shaped the price a bit and went out. So he sort of effectively operated, I don't know, a mini internal exchange on behalf of some bookmakers. I think the key behind that business was possibly Lottomatica. It's the big national operator in Italy. So he's looking to amalgamate, obviously, experiences and business opportunities across those three brands. And yeah, Pinnacle are obviously being tapped up for their experience in risk management. So in terms of what was interesting to me at Olympia, it really was, in a way, that was the most significant thing to me. I hope Pinnacle still stays as it is, much as I often poke slight fun at it for just being a glorified punting outfit. But yeah, that's interesting for me, and possibly someone who's always almost too complimentary, but I appreciate it greatly, at a luckier day, recognized that I was at Olympia and asked me if I could do a podcast on what caught my eye there and what's the future hold, and where's the gambling industry going. This is probably not the show. The betting on sports show is probably not the one to really show that, I would say. ICE is where new products are really launched and the razzmatazz happens. But there are sort of just general continuations of rather, I suppose, simple trends. So shorter bet stands, shorter bet time spans. So more and more micro betting, you know, what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, in the next 2 minutes, in the next minute, these kind of things. The request to bet phenomenon continues to evolve. Nice little small company who have a very unassuming website and product, but I think it's more suited to back-end implementation. There's a company called AlgoSport who are trying to sort of put a bit of polish on the workings, I suppose, of the request to bet, provide the calculations correctly and so on. I wouldn't know how good they are at it or anything, but I've just seen them a bit on LinkedIn, they had a small stand betting on sports. So yeah, the polishing of the request to bet product continues. But, you know, large amounts of the stands here are just affiliate stands and these kind of things. And I think there's a growing trend to provide risk services to bookmakers. There's very little I saw that will translate to significantly different or better product for the customer. I'm going to say that, unfortunately, it's certainly not a podcast worth of information out of that. Some of the talks were good. There was a very good talk on the new betting frontier that is the US, done by Jake Williams, who does the Business of Betting podcast. He was on a panel there. It was very good. And I saw some interesting one by a representative of the PGA Tour, who seemed to be very positive about the prospects of betting, and particularly on in-running betting. And they even seemed bizarrely quite super aware. I don't know how well they've been consulted or investigated, but they seemed quite hyper aware of just things like speed of data, people trying to bet on course, how to protect the data rights, the data speed, live prospect of live streaming, the idea that you could maybe watch golf on your betting website while betting on it, streaming live stats and so on. They just seem to have a real good grip compared to, say, I don't know, when I hear some representatives of the MLB or the NBA, and they seem to also have fairly reasonable expectations of the proposed integrity fees. There weren't the kind of integrity fees which would make it incredibly impossible to make money on if they were paid outside of extreme multiples, basically, which sometimes get touted. No, they seem to have a very reasonable expectation, although what I felt was a grossly inflated expectation for betting turnover. I love golf, but I don't think, it's not going to be rivaling football or anything in running anytime soon, that's for sure. But that was good. Nice little thing done by the PDC, just talking about darts, although it was largely just around, isn't darts great? Isn't betting on darts great? Yes and yes, if you're me. And then there was a good one, snooker, which Ronnie O'Sullivan was on the panel, who proved to be just as much of a rogue as possibly you'd expect, including being quite bewildered as to why players shouldn't be allowed to bet on other players, and how he could tell instantly when a player was going to win or lose. Possibly some of his audience a little surprised by some of these comments and how flippant he was with them. But he was very good value, quite amusing, very candid about how much he hates playing against crappy players, in his own words. I would much rather basically be playing just against the top 16 nonstop. And the usual stuff that I think a lot of people know about Ronnie, not a huge fan of traveling, but often frames it very sympathetically to the other pros who do have to do a lot of traveling compared to himself. But I would argue that the snooker revolution, if you want to call it, I still feel is the right direction for the game, although I'm not as into it as other people who will know much better on this. But I still think these are small tour events and so on have to be slightly in the right direction. And, Ronnie doesn't have to play in them if he doesn't want to. And interestingly, his handler, if you want to call it that, was the guy in charge of BetCris, a bookmaker which you don't necessarily associate with snooker, but they're clearly getting good value out of Ronnie as a representative, or they seem to think they are. I think there is definitely something that we all find hard to find on bookmakers' annual reports, but I'd be intrigued to know some of the Asian betting volumes on snooker, possibly. I definitely got the between the lines impression that is a bigger market than maybe I had initially thought. Stands to reason, makes sense. China loves snooker, loves betting. So, I definitely got the impression there's a bit more of that going on than meets the eye, possibly. Certainly than you would find on, the Asian-facing standard online, but, you know, SBO's website and so on, you're not left with the impression that they're pushing snooker heavily necessarily or betting it with very big limits. But there you go. There is an awful lot of betting in Asia that happens on those sites that you, I, or most of the population would find easy access to because of the very nature of the grey / black market of it. IP addresses change regularly. Website names, URLs change regularly, etc. So, yeah, no, I would say that there wasn't, you know, these were all interesting little bits and pieces, but there was no one was launching, certainly wouldn't no one use it to launch a product. There wasn't anything that I was absolutely blown away by. Those who are curious often about, I often find it interesting as to who people consider the joke, inverted commas, the joke bookmaker of current times. Of course, for a long time it was Marathon. That, of course, probably the largest turnover, I think, online of any of the Russian bookmakers in one of the largest betting markets in Russia. I'm pretty sure that they couldn't give a crap what people think of them or how much of a joke they are, or whether they close people or anything. I'm pretty sure they're doing very well for themselves. And in the same category, one would have to put the now new, I suppose, joke bookmaker target, which would be 1xBet, who has obviously a very poor reputation online and forums and so on in terms of getting your money out and them playing fair with you and so on. Again, if ever... you know, you may think they're a joke, and quite possibly they are, you know, the most harsh of recreational bookmakers and that they're not going to tolerate anything whatsoever. But I tell you, they've got a lot of money and they always have the biggest stands at all these shows. And they are, from what I understand from people I speak to in the Russian market, doing very well for themselves. So never assume that just because you can't get a bet on with these people or they close accounts or anything like that, never assume that they're not doing, you know, spectacularly well. One man's joke bookie is another man's gold mine, I would say. So, but that's just something I always find interesting when I go to them as 1xBet, have a lavish stand. Staffed by the most attractive men and women they can possibly find, free drinks and all the rest of it on it, all this kind of stuff. But yes, it always looks slightly incongruous almost compared to some of the other stands, and also the reputation that they must be, you know, grubbing along, doing a terrible job of what they do. So, yeah, so that's my little view of Olympia and the Betting on Sports Conference. But I now want to talk about, in terms of future, the real prime bit of this podcast will be what does the future hold? I'm going to talk about something that at Trotstats, his Twitter handle, mentioned. He wants to know about the impact of minimum bet laws on the betting ecosystem. Does it stimulate activity? Does it force softbooks to become sharper or just increase percentage? Or is the impact much less than people think because many people who get restricted are not long-term winners, e.g. they just happen to follow winning tips to having a good run or they were exploiting a small inefficiency that has long since disappeared? Excellent question. Very relevant question with the recent uptick in online bookmakers offering minimum bet guarantees of £500 on various levels of horse racing at various times of the day. So I'm going to take a quick intermission and then I will tackle that as the main meat of the podcast. Well, I hope you all enjoy that little transition segment called Ferris, no doubt after Ferris Bueller's Day Off, a film that I thoroughly enjoyed being a child of the 80s. Right, so minimum bet laws, probably almost impossible to talk about this without upsetting or frustrating some people. I want to look a little bit on, I suppose, what they would mean for the bookmaker, what they would mean for the punters, both recreational and sharp, and only probably a little bit into the rights and wrongs of this. I mean, we'll start with that. Should there be any imposition on a business to behave in a certain way? Businesses shouldn't be allowed to discriminate basis, you know, age, color, religion, these kind of things. Absolutely. Businesses should not be allowed to force advertise. This is probably one area where we start straight off, where people have a lot of problems, but makers advertising, by and large, promotes people who look to be having a fabulous time winning. And people take great umbrage to the fact that they will advertise the wonderful time you can have placing winning bets. And they have been denied that right with that particular company due to having their account restricted or closed. I get that. I do understand that. Of course, there's very few products that I can think of that advertise in a contrary fashion. You know, if you're a car maker, you know, you don't have some man or woman getting out the car and just sort of shrugging and going, well, it's all right, isn't it? And walking away. You know, they obviously look incredibly enthused, like, and, you know, phenomenally excited by the product. In the same way that, you know, betting is an entertainment product, a lot of people seem to think that, you know, betting should be kept separate in terms of entertainment. You know, betting is its own thing in its own bubble. For me, you know, fundamentally, betting works on the sort of the hormonal release that we get from putting something at risk, risking money. We don't become addicted to winning as such, as gamblers, or the prospect of winning. We become addicted to that hit from taking risk. And it's why, you know, problem gamblers will often take greater and greater risks to get that feeling of risk, that heightened sense of risk, because you can become your senses dulled to the initial sense. So, you know, when you're risking £2 in a fruit machine, you know, it might be £50 in a horse race, to it might be an hour's worth of putting £100 into fixed odds betting terminals. Although shortly, who knows how long it will take to implement properly. But, you know, at some point that won't be necessarily the case. But there'll be something else. There'll be casino apps. There'll be online casinos. You know, there'll be a backroom game, whatever it means. You know, gambling finds its way regardless. So that to me is that, you know, someone has put together a business which sells you the opportunity to put your money at risk and feel the sensation of having it at risk. And a lot of people, you know, would argue, no, I bet because I want to feel, because I want to win money. I want to enjoy having beaten the bookmakers. I see this as a war of intellects. That is not a palatable business. That is not a business that people with lots of money will invest in and develop. You know, the war of intellects, even, you know, your sharp bookmaker, even Pinnacle, they, you know, operate initially in when they were in the American market because they wanted to take recreational business out of America, which they used to, and maybe will again shortly, very successfully. And they evolved and transformed their, you know, their business more and more to be able to take advantage of people's intellect to then bet with others. But the advantage of them taking on sharp punters and shaping their own odds was that they then got to get on that opinion themselves by arbing with recreational bookmakers. You know, there weren't people sat in Pinnacle HQ desperate for that account that always smashed up the first price they put up. You know, so that they weren't keeping track, I imagine, necessarily of how, you know, intensely, you know, personal, you know, war with that punter, like, oh, I'm beating, you know, Mr. Jeffries out of Antigua, you know, for 3% this year. It's a great victory. No, they reshaped the game so that, you know, if Mr. Jeffries was having a good year, so were they. And their model is, you know, their model is unique-ish. But for the vast majority of people who want to invest and build a recreational bookmaker, the idea of squeezing small margins by paying a lot for a lot of technology, a lot of expertise, to beat people potentially on an even footing at all times, is not that appealing. Now, you may say, well, you know, over time, surely that builds up to the point where, you know, you've got a business that's, you know, turning over a lot of money at a slower margin. But, you know, it's still not more palatable than setting up a cheaper bookmaker, taking lots of money and taking a higher margin. So that's the problem. So that's the bit, you know, so the business plan of selling entertainment in the form of allowing people to take risk on things, that is appetizing. And you're then going to advertise people enjoying the act of betting. And presumably there are, you know, let's be honest, you know, I know there are no long-term winners with recreational bookmakers, you'd say, but there are most definitely people who have jubilant Saturdays where the ACCA wins or they make money. And, you know, those people are not, I know everyone's got the story about the, you know, massive mug mate they've got who got closed down after losing, you know, 50 grand, all the rest of it, because they placed one early morning arb one day. I'm really not bothered by all those stories. You know, it's hardly happening every day and it's thousands, you know, even if it does happen, which sometimes I'm dubious about. Lost my train of thought a little bit. The vast majority of people are allowed to win a little bit now and then, providing they bet in a fashion that is observably going to be a positive EV to the bookmaker over time. So is the advertising that false in that they are showing people, you know, at their heightened best moment of using their product in the same way we see, whoever it may be, test driving the car on the windy roads of Switzerland and the Alps, you know, slinging a sports car around corners, heightening, you know, they don't show him trying to parallel or her trying to parallel park the damn thing in Hounslow. That, you know, they show them at their sort of peak. So, you know, how awful is it that bookmakers don't fulfill entirely on the promise of their adverts? I don't know. It's not, you know. It really could be worse is my general opinion. So in terms of fairness, are bookmakers selling a false product? No more or no less than a huge sway of other people's. Do I think the world could be fairer? Absolutely. Do I think bookmaker practice could be fairer? Absolutely. I do think that wherever possible, we should aim for honesty in how we transact. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that the thing that winds me up most of all is what kind of trader email or account closure email you get. And people may, you know, find this odd, but I'm quite glad that nowadays they're quite candid. Once upon a time, you know, go back over 10 years and you used to just get the closing email, you know, sort of, you would sort of go back and forth with them a little bit and say, like, oh, you know, I see you've closed my account, you know, can you tell me what's happened here, kind of thing. Now, you know, they just come straight out and say financial decision or, you know, your business does not look profitable to us. You know, they may as well just say pretty much, you know, exactly what they think you're doing and why that will not be good for them in the long term. And in a way, I don't mind that, you know, as long as there is sort of honesty about it. And as long as there's no dirty tricks or foul play, you know, you should be allowed to walk away if you've made money, withdraw it, not have to go through too much palaver. Although KYC in the betting industry is another topic all of its own. And why some of that is necessary, even though people think that they're being made to jump through too many hoops. Is it fair that bookmakers behave the way they do, close accounts, restrict accounts? again, I just don't think of it as being particularly more fair or less fair than other areas of life. And I know that people disagree with this. I know people will say it's terrible and consider that, you know, do you consider yourself a bookmaker, etc.? Absolutely, they consider themselves a bookmaker. They consider themselves the modern version of the bookmaker. And the modern version of the bookmaker is not very dissimilar to the racetrack bookmakers of old, who would happily turn away your business, you know, happily run you out of town if you were doing something they didn't like, switch ridiculous each-way terms on you at the blink of an eye, all sorts of practices. You know, bookmakers long-term have always wanted to make money, and with fairly low volatility in it. We like talking about the great punting bookmakers of the ring and so on. You know, invariably, the great punting bookmakers of the ring had quite deep pockets. You know, volatility is relative. You know, the number of times the great punting bookmakers are actually putting their entire net worth on the line or anything like that, that is another discussion. But, you know, this idea that bookmaking now is so much different to the way it used to be, I don't buy that. This idea that, you know, modern bookmakers are so deplorable. You know, they're deplorable if you're someone who wants to be making a consistent long-term income, either part-time or full-time from them. But for the vast majority of people who use them, they're not. They just do not have that impression. So fairness, there's some little thoughts on it, you know, as to whether we should, you know, are they part, you know, is it unfair practice? Should we be interfering consequently? Now, if we didn't interfere at all ever, there'll be some, you know, full libertarians who say that, you know, there should be no government interference or any kind of exterior interference in business. But I do think that if we didn't, you know, put basic things like, you know, don't pour your toxic waste into rivers or something like that, you know, I do think there does need to be certain things to slightly rein in some of the more predatory capitalist tendencies. So, I'm happy to discuss, you know, has account restrictions and closures gone too far? You know, is the minimum bet law necessary, and how will it affect people? Right. So, bookmakers, you know, their clients, the punters, all of them have a number attached to them. All of them have a number, a monetary number of how much they cost to acquire them. So what channel did they come through? Did they open just on a whim? Did they have a bonus code? Did they come via an affiliate? Were they referred by a friend? All these kind of things. And we get a cost. Now, some of these costs are specific to the channel they came in by, like affiliates. And some of these are just general costs. So how much did the bookmaker spend on marketing, on PR, on, you know, advertising, or, you know, all that sort of online advertising, TV advertising, all the rest of it. So we take all that and we, you know, have to divide through the number of new accounts, you know, the betting promotions, you know, the free bets, all the rest of it. All these costs of client acquisition has to be taken into effect. And it is far more expensive to acquire a new customer than people think. You know, a lot of people think that the moment, you know, someone deposits, you know, 50 quid, you know, even 100 quid, that that's, you know, money, that's pure profit then and there. This is simply not the case in a very competitive market. People are having to spend huge amounts of money. A good example of this is bookmaker Betway, who have their adverts all over television and so on. They are struggling to turn a profit even because of the huge amount of money they're sinking in to try and establish a big foothold in a very competitive market. So when you have already a very expensive cost of client acquisition, you get into the mentality of wanting each client to pay not only for their own acquisition handsomely, but for more, you know, the ideal client makes you enough money to not only pay off what it costs to get his account opened, but, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 other people's accounts to be opened. So when you're fixated with that cost in mind, you get to the point where if you think about a client that's breaking even, there's still a cost. If you have a client who's even losing slowly, they're recouping the cost very slowly, and you're not sure at what point they might, they might finally, you know, lose enough to recapture the cost. They may lose money, say, you know, and recoup the cost after the first week, but then suddenly they have a few winners, they're back up. These people who tread water slash lose 1%, 2%, over time are, in a weird way, it's slightly problematic to bookmakers as well, because they're not paying their way. We really need people who are consistent, regular losers. They don't have to be huge losers, but they do need to provide a steady, stable revenue stream for bookmakers. And of course, as I've alluded to, you know, the reason the and this cost of client acquisition has gone up and up and up, because there are only so many people, you know, turning 18 each day, and that everyone is fighting to get their business. And so we have more and more aggressive promotions, bonuses, all the rest of it, to get people in. And there are, on top of that, people who are specifically attacking the bonuses. So match bettors or bonus abusers, if they want to be called that. Even something that used to be just guaranteed zero trouble, like online casinos, you know, even those now having their promotions targeted. You know, people used to obviously think, well, I can't lose on these because all the perfect, you know, the algorithms have the margin perfectly built in. But, you know, if people playing disciplined, perfect blackjack and using a promotion or free spins on the, you know, fruit machines, all the rest of it, you know, there are people who are systematically beating the promotion long-term on those and, you know, can hit you on that. So these people, these new accounts, they are added to the cost of acquiring the other accounts. Arbors, winners, all of them, if they're not making money for you, they dilute the efficacy of your client acquisition strategy and make it more expensive to get the good clients. To put this into sort of a picture, is I spoke to someone who set up a new bookmaker, online bookmaker, and after 2 years, they felt very happy that they felt they had 30% of accounts as genuine, and he described genuine as accounts that were not for definite long-term negative EV for the company. So even in that 30%, there were some that the jury was still out on, but there were 70% who were pure, open for the bonus, opened to arbitrage, all these kind of things, a repeat opening of those same people who tried to do the bonus abuse to the arbitrage. So, you know, and, you know, he said of that 30%, every chance that maybe 10% could fall by the wayside in that direction. So what do we get? We get 20-80, we get Pareto. So every chance that at least 80% of your earnings will be made by 20% of your client base, which puts a huge amount of stress on that 20% to consistently lose and makes those that other 80% incredibly expensive. So you've got that situation where anything that damages the bottom line for bookmakers will be added on top of that cost of client acquisition. So we look at something like the minimum bet laws. Now, for a punter, suddenly, if you've been closed previously, you're allowed to bet to win, most commonly at the moment for the minimum bet laws, £500. Australia, I think, launched it with $1,000, New South Wales. But the UK books seem to be hovering around £500. And they're often restricting it as a teaser right now to maybe either televised races or racing after 11 a.m. or indeed just class 3 and above, I think is one of the other categories. So you're someone who previously made money off a bookmaker, you're being closed or restricted, And now you get to come back and bet on, let's call it predominantly higher grade racing after the complete, I'm not saying racing prices are, you know, particularly accurate at 11 a.m., but you're betting on the higher grade of racing when at least some of the market volatility has filtered out by 11 a.m. So that is, you know, something for you to be happy about. What are you going to do if you're a serious punter at this point? Well, the moment you get this opportunity, if you are someone who happened to be quite good at horse racing betting, largely just because, you know, you followed it, you watched a lot of racing, did a little bit of your own form here and there, maybe, you know, spoke to friends, exchanged ideas, went on, you know, the internet, looked up things, all the rest of it, then those people probably will feel a genuine benefit. Suddenly they're allowed to have the bets that they, you know, have been denied having. They generally want to bet on the better races. This is sort of the person that all of the framing of the minimum bet laws is targeting. This tiny, tiny percentage of people, because, you know, horse racing popularity is in decline, especially amongst younger people. You know, this idea that there is this sort of avid horse racing, you know, by definition, they're almost dying off, literally. So this wizened expert amateur, you know, horse racing punter. So for that very small percentage of people, great. You know, this probably feels like maybe just enough to keep them happy. Then there'll be the other people who now is open up an opportunity to generate serious turnover. People who take betting seriously as a second side income or even their full-time income. So what they're going to do is they're going to target specifically races where there'll be any deemed obvious mathematical edge via overlays, so overbroke place parts in races, potentially, you know, it'll be all any arbitrage opportunities. So potentially, it certainly will be any arbitrage opportunities. And it'll be looking to play these opportunities as much as possible all day, every day. You're going to be competing against other people doing this. So if possible, you'll want to be using some sort of bot, which will log into the bookmaker's account for you, maybe go to a greater or lesser effort to replicate human behavior on the site, but basically place those bets for you. And you'll want to then potentially go further and maybe have several bots doing this with several accounts, because providing they're all allowed to get the 500 on, so much the better. It may be that you know, each bot only gets on once, potentially. But it's still worth it just in case, you know, one bot misfires, one doesn't. You know, sometimes you get to double dip, sometimes you don't. So there'll be a variety of people who'll be looking to exploit this as much as possible. These people will add to already the slender margins of certainly singles and each way bets, horse racing. You know, the multiples business is still good, but it's not, you know, it's not nowhere near as big was, you know, obviously historically, when, you know, horse racing was king. You know, now football is by far and away the most popular, and horse racing is taking much of a back seat. So for those people who their account opening was acquired due to their interest in horse racing, well, the cost of acquiring people who want to bet on horse racing has just shot up dramatically because of people like that potentially grinding those edges. So as a bookmaker, what do you do? Well, and this may sound a bit drastic, but, you know, you can ditch horse racing. You know, there are people almost certainly out there, smaller bookmakers, who are assessing the cost of potentially adding horse racing. Some, you know, people add horse racing late now because it's quite hard to find a decent third-party solution for horse racing. And you know, there's no guarantees that you'll be able to do it, you know, that well yourself. So there may be some people who say, do you know what, if this minimum bet law comes in across the board, I'm probably not even going to bother getting into it, to be honest. But there are potentially people who will be there going, right, well, we want to keep offering horse racing. We know there are some people who will only bet with a bookmaker where they can do all their bits and pieces, and some of that does include horse racing. So how can we, you know, for those people, we're happy for them to, it's almost a case of they're one person betting on multiple things, but we want them to pay their acquisition cost through a football promotion or through a golf promotion or some other thing, or, you know, free casino spins, whatever it may be. But we don't want them, we don't want the cost of acquisition for them to be lumped in with horse racing, because horse racing is already struggling to make good money. So basically, we have to make horse racing leaner and the cost of acquisition for that part of the business more efficient. So things that come under threat, over rounds, we can potentially recoup some of that cost through increased over rounds. Best odds guaranteed, that can potentially go. We might, if we're not a UK-facing book, I imagine, be tempted to separate win and place in order to avoid some of the more, you know, loss-making areas of each way over broke books. You know, I don't think you can offer UK horse racing, honestly, to a UK customer base without offering each way properly on it. Do you contemplate offering different each way terms? It's a funny thing that it's either all or nothing. If no bookmaker breaks ranks, no other bookmaker is going to choose to break ranks on breaking the conventional each way terms. You know, if Bet365 said that, you know, all 16 runner handicaps, they're going to start paying fifth the four instead of quarter the four, fine. But they're exactly the ones who aren't going to, because their size means that they're able to better soak up the cost of client acquisition better than anyone. In fact, you know, the bigger you are, the more organic account opening, people you don't have to pay through affiliation or things like that, the more immune you are to this. So they're the kind of people who will be able to stand bog the longest. They'll be able to keep the overrounds down the longest. You know, they will, in the survival of the fittest, or rather survival of the promotions, they will be able to keep that cost from filtering through to horse racing. So you'll get bookmakers who pretty much have horse racing as just a side product. It's there. Anyone who ends up having a bet on their horse racing product probably be doing it at a poor rate or level compared to what else is available in the industry. But it doesn't matter, because it, you know, they like your football product, and it, you know, they're happy enough that they can place their horse racing bet without having to log into another site. And maybe they like your app or whatever, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So we also have the situation where bookmakers will look to come at it from another direction. Now, I did an interview with David Perdue of ESPN for a piece that he put up about account limiting and restrictions, the possibilities in America. And one of the things I was quoted on, I wish I'd got the recording of the interview off David, because I thought we both did quite a good job of it, to be honest. I would have probably liked to have released that. But one of the things I was quoted as saying was, be careful what you wish for. Which makes for, you know, smart punters. Now, never confuse this. You know, there will always be punters who are smarter than the bookmaker. The very dynamic that you have to put up all the prices, they only need to bet one, that dynamic will forever mean that there is someone out there who is able to beat the book, always. So it will not, you know, I never suggested that you could eliminate sharp punters from this equation, ever. But be careful what you wish for, because an awful lot of people who talk about, you know, why can't bookmakers lay a bet? You know, why can't they just do what they're supposed to, all the rest of it? Awful lot of these people, if certain changes would be made, would find their ability to make money or beat bookmakers squeezed hard. Now, what could, you know, bookmakers who suddenly are forced to find a way to sort of sharpen up their horse racing product, what would they do? Well, okay, first of all, believe it or not, not everyone, everyone says, oh, just let the exchange price it for you. Now, not everyone is as linked to the exchange as you'd think. A lot of people actually respond to basically alerts telling them they're an ARB and moving these prices after the fact, rather than just having the exchange pull them around. And part of this is there's, you know, a fear of someone pushing out a price on the exchange, you blindly tracking this as a bookmaker, and then someone hitting you on the non-ARB but pushed out price on your bookmaker. This is a sensible fear to have. However, if you're linked up to the exchange and you're betting some horse race to 120%, you can hook it up if you want, so that if there's a plunge on the exchange, your price will follow the plunge. So suddenly you go from betting it to 120 to 130. And people are like, well, surely you've got to push it out. Well, you can push out the other runners. You don't have to. You can just leave it there, see where the rest of the exchange reforms after one horse has taken the plunge, and slowly settle back into shape. People can put more effort into how they choose to track the exchange. And by doing this, you know, because the thing is that there's, you know, fivers and tenors up there. It looks like there's no money at all. Often there isn't very much money. But a lot of this is drip feed bots. So, you know, we can have systems that track where the money was traded, how regularly it's trading, you know, the gap between the back and lay. There's a million ways that you could improve basically something that still basically at the end of the day copies the exchange for horse racing. Part of the problem is that a lot of people they're trying to keep it above board. You know, it's unlikely for a lot of these bigger bookmakers that they'll want to encourage their tech team to just voraciously scrape Betfair quite often, you know, and they don't, you know, if you're a company, you don't get access to the cheapo API that the punters get access to. You know, a business API connection to Betfair is considerably expensive. Add that to the client acquisition costs for horse racing. So if you wanted to do that, so you wanted to basically prevent any ARBs, and then let's say you've got it connected to the place book, so place price shortens, you know, you then basically, let's say it's classic 16-runner handicap, and you decide that you're going to price your outright just off the place book. So, you know, it's literally just placebook multiplied by, you know, multiplied by four plus overround, you know, add overround to the Betfair placebook, multiply by four for the, you know, the win price. So, you know, you effectively eliminate that. Now you're saying, God, if you do that, you're going to be betting, you know, particularly like 8-runner handicaps, you know, you're going to be betting 8-runner handicaps to 140%. At this point, you've put them into a corner where they couldn't give a fuck, I'm afraid. Again, people who can avoid this, you may say, well, people who employ better traders, possibly, needs more money, need to be a bigger bookmaker. People who can just wear the erosion of, you know, minimum bet clients hacking away at this, again, bigger bookmakers. So, you know, when I said be careful what you wish for, you know, this is the kind of thing that people have not gone to such great lengths. Now, at some point, it's possible that a third-party provider for horse racing will really sharpen it up. You know, they maybe actually pay a small team to come up with some better, say, anti-post prices for you, maybe package up tracking the exchange a bit better for you, do a bit of risk management for you, you know, move the odds, not just basis the exchange movements, but some business, you know. And so maybe that can then be packaged to people. And so the smaller players will be able to have a semi-intelligent, but any company that's bringing to market a really good horse racing product, it'll have to be really good. It'll have to be something that can survive minimum bet law pressures. And so you're thinking, right, so you may now be thinking, listening to this, thinking, well, that's, you know, great. They're doing their job better. People are allowed to have a bet and so on. It's great, but I'm thinking to myself, well, yeah, they're doing their job better. They've got bigger overrounds. They've got no best odds guaranteed. Got no free bets. You know, to be used on horse racing, all the rest of it. No, you know, paying out twice for first past the post and all that shit. You know, none of that. So I'm there thinking to myself, at this point, how many people are still making money with none of that left? How many people are actually benefiting from the minimum bet laws? And how many people are suffering? So how many people who enjoyed horse racing and lost slowly at horse racing comfortably because of all these promotions, all these nice things, are now, you know, got a product that's really distressing? They're going to go to football, potentially. The bookmaker's not going to give a shit because they're happy for them to go to football, where the costs are far cheaper. You know, it might just be a cheapo third-party feed for football. May not even have any bloody traders, you know, or anything, really. So, you know, the people who will suffer in that situation are the recreational punters. Well, should those recreational punters just be happy that they're now playing a fair game, a tough, fair game? I don't know. I mean, I've got some friends. I've got plenty, bizarrely enough. Well, I don't have plenty of friends. That's a lie. I've got some friends. But and I've got even fewer friends outside of betting. But those friends I have who don't work in betting, some of them are very successful people, very good at what they do, earn plenty of money. For example, I've got a friend, works as a chartered surveyor, does incredibly well for himself, considered, you know, really top of his profession, youngest to do this, youngest to do that, that kind of character. And he loves cricket, member at Surrey. And every year he backs Surrey to win whatever competitions they're in. Every game he goes to, pretty much backs Surrey to win, backs one of the Surrey players to be top bat, whether they're batting second, first, or whatever. Quite happily backs middle order people, you know, who just likes, you know, likes their style or whatever. Now, it's just the absolute dream. And you speak to him and, you know, you talk about account closures and betting. And this doesn't affect. And he just looks at me and says, "It's business, isn't it, really?" And I go, "Well, yeah, but aren't you annoyed that, you know, if you made money, you'd get your account closed?" And he said, "Well, don't expect to make money, do I? I'm not doing it to make money." Now, you may think, oh, well, you've got one weird friend there. Maybe I do, or maybe my friend is just like thousands upon thousands upon thousands of other people out there. You know, that's a question to be asked. But, you know, in his case, he's not actually even going to be, he's just oblivious. He, you know, he could be backing, you know, Surrey at 4-6 when there's 6-4 available elsewhere, and it just wouldn't bother him. But those people, you know, sort of further down the food chain in terms of recreational punters, the smaller punters, you know, they're going to feel the impact of the racing product being considerably less fun, you know, considerably less, you know, oh, I thought I didn't get paid there, but it turns out there was an extra place. Oh, that's nice. Or have I'll straight away, you know, have what I've made on that race back on the next race. All those people who get little bits of joy out of, you know, these sort of promotional aspects, their fun will come under threat. And, of course, you know, as I said, the bookmakers potentially get better at what they do and squeeze it so only the most technologically savvy, the fastest, you know, the most competent, let's say, you know, mathematical edge abusers or the people who just know horse racing better. There definitely are plenty, you know, in horse racing in particular, there are plenty of people who are, you know, capable of beating even a well hooked up exchange price, you know, early prices. I have no doubt of that. I'm sure that's absolutely possible. And there'll be plenty of people, I'm sure, when they realize if the industry went this way, you know, they'll smartly figure out how to beat the bots that are, you know, driving these bookmaker copying prices, automated bookmaker copying prices. So they'll be, but you know, they'll have put themselves on the war footing, the bookmakers. They will now be competing hard against you to be the very best at this to reduce the costs. Or alternatively, maybe they'll be the very biggest bookmakers and they will just soak it up for a time. But at the same time, those people who are offering minimum bet laws on horse racing, well, until there's minimum bet laws across everything, they might close you down on everything but horse racing. So that'd be weird, wouldn't it? You know, so you're losing money on football, but you're making money on horse racing. But because your cost of your account is so high on horse racing, they can't afford to let you bet on anything else. It's, you know, you get these weird little scenarios that could happen. So, you know, that, you know, like I said, that is where I'm coming from with be careful what you wish for. But ultimately, my biggest fear is the collapse of competition. You know, I'm not saying bookmakers will close off the back of this per se, but bookmakers may stop offering horse racing or offer such a poor horse racing product as to make no difference. So then it comes down that there'll be three or four bookmakers in Britain who offer any sort of horse racing product. And once everyone else has given up the ghost at doing it decently, you know, they will be able to take the piss a little bit. You know, they'll be able to push it up to 2% a runner, over around 2.5% a runner, 3%, you know, God knows. As long as they're all keeping each other in line with each other, you know, one may duck under here, one might offer an extra place there on this big race or something like that. But generally, the whole product, the pressure of competition will be off for them, and their product can get that little bit worse across the board for everyone. So, you know, from, and, you know, they may take slightly less business on horse racing, but they've seen horse racing volumes dip anyway. So they may just consider it to be part of, you know, the way the industry, that part of the industry is going. And you know, you'll find yourself in a situation where you're trying to make money on minimum bet laws into bookmakers who are giving you a very unproductive, uncompetitive product to do it on. So, is it better? I think for me, I would like to see it expanded. If it's going to happen, I'd want to see it everywhere, across all sports, all markets. And I think it would be lower than people expect. Because even the friend I was speaking about, you know, this guy earns a lot of money in his surveying job. You know, very, very wealthy guy. Those top bats, he likes to have 20 quid on. You know, just because people are wealthy, you know, well, it doesn't mean necessarily mean that they demand big amounts to bet to enjoy it, for it to be enjoyable recreation. So I think if you're going to have minimum bet laws, you know, they're very low across the entire spectrum. And potentially, they are the rule. You know, the minimum bet laws also become the maximum bet laws. So, you know, everyone can bet to take out 500, but no one can bet to take out more than 500. If you think of that world. Now, you may think, like, well, that's just ridiculous. Again, you might be surprised about how few people that impacts a bookmaker. There are an awful lot of people outside of accumulators who will never, ever place a bet that takes out close to £500. There are some bookmakers whose average stake, you know, depending on the part of the world, you know, I've seen bookmakers where the average stake is less than 10p, you know, in more poorer regions. You know, and other bookmakers where maybe £5, you know, that kind of region. And the vast majority of the bets they take will never have a payout, you know, singles, never larger than £5. Now, obviously, you'd have different, you know, rules for accumulators. For the smart punters out there, I'm sure that they will put more effort into thinking how to employ accumulators if this world existed. But it's very easy right now. If you're Bet365, it's very easy for you to run a calculation across all the business you have and calculate what respectable bet limit you could impose across every market and every match, you know, every league, a bet limit that is both minimum and maximum and would still be, you know, fairly optimal for the business. Now, what you do end up then is cutting off the real cream, the real stuff that you really want. I'm not going to, you know, talk about the people who are addicts, which is, you know, a nasty area to talk about. But the people who are just big punters who are happy to lose big and have been doing it for years, who are not necessarily addicts, you know, those people, they're not going to suddenly like the fact that they go on their app and they can only bet to lose 500 quid on, you know, the Premier League, you know, under over 2.5 goals. So I can easily see that bookmaking can, you know, turn into a situation where there is very low maximum slash minimum bet law amounts, and there is a second tier. Because let's say you put all these limits in, and, you know, they're great in one sense for bookmakers. You know, you could make a very big deal about how you're protecting people, you know, these lower limits, you know, people can't lose too much, all the rest of it. It's got a great PR message about looking after people. But the same day you do it, you have a group of, you know, crack team of, you know, 10, 20, however many people you need, and they're busy calling up the cream of the crop. Hello, sir. This is the Bet365 Platinum team. How are you today? And the funny thing is that these people, once upon a time, the VIP desks have really died a death over the last years. You know, everyone's all about just getting the online faceless punter in. If suddenly you went this way, you could then have a resurgence of these kind of desks, except now it's not the guy who's dropping, you know, 10, 50 grand a week. You know, it'll be the guy potentially who's dropping 500 quid a week, or less even, but doing it every week, every year. The guy who lost a few grand every year to you for the last 10 years. Suddenly that guy's maybe getting a phone call from someone asking him if he'd like to take part in a new promotion where you get free bet the weekend racing or whatever like that. Suddenly all these benefits and bonuses that have been available to everyone are now only available to those people who've proven themselves historically to be, you know, good clients. Now, you could also potentially have an element of some people might get offered platinum status based on some sort of KYC check. Maybe you do some sort of experience-style credit check when someone opens an account. You might take a punt. You might say, right, this guy's credit rating is ridiculous. Because the thing about professional gamblers is that establishing credit when you're a professional gambler, mortgage payments, all this kind of things that generally get you good credit can be a bit of a challenge at times. So, you know, if you did it on credit check, right, this guy's got an incredible credit rating, must have taken out credit cards, mobile phone contracts, mortgages, all the rest of it. Right, well, we'll forward his contact details straight on to the Platinum team. You know, alternatively, you might then have just this sort of min-max thing where you get the bet and then it refers the rest to a trader. The trader looks at it and goes, right, okay, each way bad, each way race. No. And goes on the never invite to Platinum ever again list. Or alternatively, it's something that's just fabulous, like European handicaps, you know, those three-way handicaps, not the Asian ones, or double chance, or, you know, odd or even total points in a basketball game, this kind of, you know, at which point they're like, right, well, not only are we happy to lay him over what he's asked. And the truth is that you could get a machine to do this for you quite easily, make a decision based on the type of bet, you know, whether it's, you know, you're sort of automating the submit to trader kind of process. Because right now it's sort of yes, no. A lot of rejections with bookmakers. But you could easily automate the, you know, and don't get me wrong, I'm sure there'll be savvy bookmakers who realize, oh, yeah, well, double chance always goes through. All right, well, if ever there's an ARB on the plus a half handicap on the Asian handicaps, you know, that I can exploit, well, I know that the, you know, on the double chance and Asian handicap ARB kind of thing, I can always get that through. It'll be a constant battle, but like all these things, you know, the more you push bookmakers to evolve, potentially the more they will. Although one thing I will say after all this conversation is all of this has the potential to happen very slowly. You know, right now, the adoption of the minimum bet laws, I don't predict there'll be an avalanche. I don't predict someone will suddenly go, I could be very wrong here, but I don't predict someone will suddenly go, look, we're going to lay everything on the site to lose $5,000 tomorrow. You know, first it will be horse racing, the slightly lower level horse racing, maybe at 9 o'clock, not 11 o'clock. You know, someone's almost certainly going to do Premier League, I'd imagine, at some point, or top five football leagues, lay to lose, whatever, no matter who you are, on the day of the kick, or on the day of the match, all these kind of things. I can definitely see a lot of these things happening, but very, very slowly. So I'm just going to go back to Trotstat's original question, see if I've covered everything. Impact minimum bet laws on the betting ecosystem has the potential to make life, particularly if it's a sport where not great margins have been made at the bookmaker, makes life much worse for the recreational bookmaker and tougher for the person who thinks they have a decent edge, but maybe their edge is not as big as they thought. Does it stimulate activity? It stimulates the wrong kind of activity from a bookmaker's perspective. I don't think the minimum bet laws increases recreational punters' appetite to bet, but it does increase people who got an appetite to somehow abuse the system, I suppose. Does it force softbooks to become sharper? Potentially. I think they'll resist it because all the expensive ways of becoming much sharper at what they do, all the best ways of becoming much sharper at what they do are quite expensive, whereas just whacking a bit more margin on stuff costs you nothing. But definitely I think it could go that way, or just increase percentage. Or is the impact much less people think, because many people get restricted and not long-term winners? I think most people, contrary to what people think, most people who get restricted have done something that has been long-term negative EV for a bookmaker. The question is how many opportunities do they give you at it? So the problem being that if you place a bet on a horse that shortens dramatically and it happens to be the same horse that a load of other people who've got more consistent track records backing horses that shorten significantly, you can get restricted or closed after one bet. You undoubtedly did do something that would be negative long-term EV to them. However, there's no real way of knowing whether you did it deliberately, so they've taken a punt on it. But for this very reason, I've always felt that if you're going to restrict, you really should restrict via sport level, to be quite honest. If you're that fearful of horse racing business, maybe you should just turn your racing product into, a very bland, vanilla, high overround product and just not expect to take anything on it, and then try and isolate those clients who are big fans of your racing product and give them preferential treatment instead. So rather than assume everyone's a fabulous client and then cull, assume everyone is a moderate to poor client and then elevate significantly those people who look to be better than average. E.g., they just happen to follow winning tips to having a good run, or they're exploiting small and fishy that's long since disappeared. Yes, I think a lot of people maybe who have been restricted were in those categories. And the minimum bet laws may actually bring some of them back, and we will see how they do. How many good winning tipsters are there winning after 11 as opposed to overnight prices or early morning prices on only pretty good racing once there's at least a little bit of a market formed? We'll find out. Be nice to see tipsters who are proofing only to minimum bet limit bets and minimum bet law bookmakers. See how that would fare. Someone like the Secret Betting Club, I'm sure could track all their tipsters' basis what was available at 11 o'clock on the tips in the size. How much could you make? Although I don't think it's no longer called the Secret Betting Club. Someone can clarify. I mean, maybe it's called the Smart Betting Club now instead. Anyway, I'm sure someone can tell me that on Twitter. So there you go. Once again, I've lost my train of thought quite a few times in this podcast. I apologize for that. I think I've outlined a lot of the potential difficulties with the, in handling the minimum bet laws. But I also want to say that it could well lead to a general overall better practice in bookmakers. Whether you like it or not, I don't know. But the base principle of allowing people to bet, forcing people to bet in smaller size and allowing only the people who really are, can afford to bet in bigger size to do so, actually would protect the clients more and, would limit the damage that potentially smart bettors who get on with you. In terms of, I'm sure one last thing would be people saying, well, if you've got minimum bet laws, surely people have to start using the information more intelligently with smart bettors. It depends. You could end up using the information and realize that all you're doing is moving fast movers on the exchange, basically. And that may be one way. If you've got them to move, you automated the movement of your prices based on the bets you take, that might actually work out long-term cheaper than paying for a good exchange feed or a good third-party feed. But yes, the idea that, bookmakers will be able to really break down who are the people who really know their horse racing as opposed to people who are just looking for arbs, mathematical edges, that kind of thing. I don't know. I think there's definitely more mileage to be got out of that in other sports. But horse racing is tough. Right. Okay. I'm going to leave you all now. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And like I say, once again, anyone who can do me a little logo would really appreciate it. Anyone who wants to come on, be interviewed, do it with me. Fabulous. And yeah, keep the ideas coming. And I hope you tune in for the next one, which will be episode 11.